Now, for those of you who follow me on other platforms, you're probably aware that I haven't been in Spokane for the last week. I've been all the way over in New York. And I was checking out the Catskills and Putnam County and all kinds of ancient, or maybe not ancient, stonework. All kinds of stonework that's a whole lot older than me anyway, and I'm ancient. That's why you only got one video last week, and it was just, if you watch Hugh Newman, you already had seen the video, and I knew my numbers would reflect that, but what do you do? I wanted to give you guys at least something and make sure that YouTube didn't think that I died or something, but I've been out of state, and I was running around checking out all these different cool sites with a couple of locals. One of them is my girlfriend Tammy. The other one, you guys probably know him, and if you don't, you need to. His name's Trevor Grassi, not Travis Grassi. Trevor Grassi, and he is a YouTuber who is extremely an alternate researcher. He's extremely into the pyramid, the Khafre scan, the SAR stuff that I've covered in the past. And I got a chance to sit down and talk to him, and we discussed a lot of different things about the region because he knows a lot of cool stuff about there. He's been there all of his life, and he's been into this stuff for a long time. So I sat down and spoke with him for about 20, 30 minutes after we had hiked around for the better part of a day. This is going to be that interview with a couple of other excerpts of when we were talking throughout the day. In the future, I will be covering some of the sites that I went to there, and I've already got another video that's halfway. The script's almost done, and it's going to be coming out in a few more days, but I just got back into Spokane last night. I'm tired, but I need to give you guys something, and Trevor's a good guy, so go check him out. His link to his channel is down below, and, hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to the Dunky. I'm sitting here with Trevor Grassi. Those of you who aren't aware, he's got a link down below to his channel. And we're at, what dam is this thing?
It's called Little Deep.
Little Deep. All right.
It's at that Woodstock, New York. And there's actually a swimming hole up the stream from here that's called Big Deep, and it's tiny, but this is Little Deep, and it's huge. It's one of the weird things in Catskills.
Yeah. Catskills been pretty nice. He's taking us around a little bit and letting us see some of the cool places up here. Some of the rock formations and stuff, and I'll put some video and whatnot of our conversations and stuff down below. We saw Opus 40, which is really interesting. You want to talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, Opus 40 is one of my favorite spots, and I'm really excited to get to you, especially because it is technically a modern megalithic site. There is at least one 9-ton stone at the center, the obelisk, really impressive. But it was just the vision of one man, Harvey Fight, which makes it so awesome to me. That's why I got my Coral Castle shirt on, because it's very much like Hedley Scanlon who made Coral Castle. It came just from the vision of one man. He started building it. He didn't really know what he was building. He kept adjusting. And originally, this was just a bluestone quarry, which is the type of stone that this dam is made out of back here. It's local Castle Mountain bluestone, which is a sedimentary stone. It's like a sandstone technically, but it's a really awesome patio stone, or like building for walls and patio walkways.
Stuff like that, it looks like it would be really good for a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, very flat, a lot like slate. So yeah. you can make
beautiful, a good painting stone.
Yeah, yeah. So it's one of the things I love about the Catskills. I've been working with bluestone since I was like 14 years old. Getting jobs with doing all of it dry laid, which means no mortar. It's all just stacked and put in place. So the other thing, it's, better for tectonic movements, or if there's, disasters or anything, it holds up better. Not there's much of that in the Catskills, but
yeah,
the dry stone laying is, it reminds me of the ancients. They didn't use mortar, but it's not quite like they did, but some of this work from even, I don't know, maybe a century or longer ago. It's so impressive to me, what we've done in modern times. Harvey Fight, he was the Edley Scalman of the Catskills, I think. So he's a hero of mine. He started building this site. It's called Opus 40 because he was planning on spending 40 years to build it, but sadly died in the 37th year. So it was his magnum opus of his whole life called the Opus 40. But, I'm really glad you got to see it. We have a long history of Woodstock and the Catskill Mountains being an artist colony. So it's all artisans and painters and sculptors and people who came up here first. And he's one of the ultimate representations of that entire field of the whole
place. Yeah, it's definitely a unique site. I mean, I can see why you compare it to the Sistler or Foyle Castle. I've never been to Foyle Castle, but you know, I've read about it and seen videos and photographs and stuff. And you see, with one dude putting a bunch of effort into it and using machines and whatnot, it's minimal machinery, but using some to get simple machines to get as much as he could. That site was pretty crazy. Some of the other stuff that we showed us, that you showed me, was the some of these rock walls that Tammy was showing me. The one that you showed me just a little bit ago looked like a snake. And you were showing me in that book by, oh, come on, what's his name? I know his name.
Glenn Kreisberg.
Yeah,
he's a good friend of mine now. I haven't gone up to hike to any of these spots with him. I keep talking about it, but we're going to get some drones up there and get some good footage. But he's been working on this for a long time, and his book, Spirits in Stone, it has so much great research from him. It aligns with all this archaeoastronomy we're seeing in Egypt and all over the world. There's at least one spot on Lewis Hollow where he's found this correlation with a bunch of these, call them cairns, like C-A-I-R-N-S, meaning just like big piles of stone, you know, laid out in piles or walls, basically. But that's like the local equivalent of building a pyramid or a mound, like the mound builders all over the country. So you see a lot of them all over the place. So many that it's impossible to attribute them all to post-colonial times. We know that, you know, at least 90-95% of them are ancient, or at least pre-colonial.
Well, I mean, the one that you showed me, there's no, this doesn't look like a property demarking line of any sort. It doesn't look like, this isn't farmland, and there won't be farm that land ever. The ground's still full of rock. So there's no, doesn't seem like any reason that a settler would have put those rocks there. So my white man brain, I do not see why we put rocks here. So it does, you want to, I can see why there's a lot of speculation on a lot of these. I mean, clearly some of, you drive by and clearly some of the shit is modern or like this stack of rocks right there. That was not done maybe 100 years ago at the older, you know? But it's not very old. But there's other places where you look like that snake. That shit's old, man. That's been around for a hot minute.
Yeah, there's a lot of serpent-like ones that I know most walls are basically serpent shaped, but you've got these big headstones that seem to accentuate it as a serpent, which is, of course, is a very powerful symbol in the shamanic cultures. It, you know, serpents a lot of times are either speaking of energies or waveforms, or speaking of contact points into the earth, like they're ways of communicating with elemental spirits and things like that. And like many other cultures, it goes hand in hand with bird symbolism, like the thunderbird you hear about. A lot of times these are different. They have religious significance, you know, they have a spiritual significance like many of the other animals. We see like cat-shaped stones here. We see turtles, a lot of turtle stones, which is one of the easier ones to make. Stones that are kind of shaped like that already. But a lot of these things that are sure signs that there was clearly some kind of inheritance of knowledge or understanding of the stars and how to use stones to track the stars or mark certain time periods, even like marking out Draco, for instance. This was right after Graham Hancock had his Draco correlation. I guess and we do know that it's reasonable to suspect that, you know, Draco might have been significant because the pole star was a Draco a few thousand years ago. There's that, and then there's just these sight lines marked at the equinox, you know, solstice sunrise and equinox sunrise and some death. You have sets of stones that match to each other, and you can mark when the equinoxes are, things like that. But these are things we see in Egypt, we see in Peru, we see in Mexico, and all the different megalithic cultures. You know, it's not so much only the style of stonework, but it's the alignment and how the archaeoastronomy works with it that clearly show there's something more than just natives piling up stones.
Archaeoastronomy is so often just dismissed entirely as, and it's like, it can be speculative at times, but it can also be very profound. So it's funny to me how when they dismiss these things, The same people that will dismiss the archaeoastronomy associated with these stone walls are the same people that are going to say that the four cardinal points are represented in the medicine wheel, which they're right. The medicine wheel, four cardinal points are the four cardinal points. So why wouldn't they do that with rocks, too? It's like, it's like there's this fucking disconnect. It hurts my head.
I mean,
if you study the field, there is reasons to be skeptical about certain things. You know, there's like 22 things that are big in the sky that they say you need to, like, these are the ones that are most likely to get alignments to, but they also are going to quite often naturally make those alignments. But when you have multiples of the same thing like this, you got a bunch of different rock walls that are pointing, doing the same thing, all of a sudden this isn't speculation anymore, right? Yeah. It's much like in Malta, they argue about which star those doors are pointed at, but after you see that those doors tend to follow some star moving, it becomes a whole lot more than it's just the sun making you simple. Yeah. Sorry, I know we're not in Malta, but
it's similar. Actually, I was going to bring up the archaeoacoustics as well. It's something that it's another one of those fields, another sub-branch of archaeology that's becoming a whole field in itself, because really it's so many, especially in Malta, where you have these specifically tuned chambers, and the acoustics are part of the science that are incorporated there. So Glenn Kreitzberg actually gets a lot into that in the Catskills also.
What?
Actually, he's got a great Facebook group called Archaeoacoustics something. I'll give you the link.
Yeah, I'll check them out.
Really interesting studies about that, a lot of academic papers and things he shared. I was just bringing up some of the Tom Danley acoustic experiments from the Great Pyramid that happened in the 90s, which are pretty interesting. But I think that goes hand in hand with the knowledge of the stars. And like you say, I don't jump on conclusions. If it is aligned at some time period, that's interesting. But when we see, you know, 5-10 different confirmations of the same thing, like many of these different cultures, they're all focused on, I'll tell you, mostly it's Orion, the Pleiades, and Sirius. Those are the big three, I'll tell you, all over the world. And, you know, Graham and his Angkor Wat theory, it's interesting, but I've also heard Wayne Herzog has another one about that. And he thinks it's a different constellation, but using a different constellation basically to point to the Pleiades. You hold a temple at Angkor Wat complex is actually this collection of seven temples, which I think it's Pleiades.
Yeah, Nimbus.
You can also look up, there's 1,000 different towns across the world that are all known as the city on seven hills. So Rome is probably the most famous. Yeah. Rome is actually built on these seven hills that represent Pleiades and love. But there are so many other towns and settlements around the world that have that same schema. Tikal has seven temples in one little corner. It's really fascinating. And Orion is just everywhere. You have the Lakota in the Black Hills. They do ceremonies. They move in this sacred hoop throughout the year to the different peaks of the Black Hills. And one of them's Sirius, one of them's Orion. They go to have ceremonies throughout the year, depending on what star is in the sky. And then, the other guy just came up. Gary Anderson. he was finding all these correlations to Orion out in the Midwest. And you know, everybody knows about the Great Pyramid, Orion, correlation from Babal. Steph talked about a bit too. I think you've talked about that as well. I think there's other sites in Egypt that really cement that into place, even though there's some things that say, oh, maybe it wasn't, maybe there was another pyramid, a fourth one. But I think the work of Gary Osborne, for one thing, of Scott Creighton in a book called The Giza Prophecy, goes much deeper. It's what I was telling you a little bit before about how the two sets of satellite pyramids in Giza align to Orion's cell, like the main three pyramids, but at these different points in the processional cycle. So they're actually measuring the two extreme tilts of the sky 13,000 years apart. So I think that not only proves that Giza was much, much earlier, or at least the knowledge of the people who built it goes back much earlier, the records of the stars, but also proves that the Orion correlation is true, pretty much.
Yeah, and, it's, The Orion correlation is one where it becomes very mathematically improbable for it to be an accident, especially like when you look at the inverse correlation with the magnitudes of the stars. I've always seen that. But bigger the pyramid of those three on Giza, the bigger the pyramid, the smaller the star is meant to represent. And it follows a straight line. It's not just like random. It's on a straight graduate. There's been more work done by the handful of archaeoastronomers who aren't like just knee-jerking because it's not all associated with Atlantis. They always are looking for fourth dynasty dates, right? But they find other data like that. And it gets to the point where it's like you've got their myth says Orion with importance to all their rebirth bullshit. We've got Orion laid out quite possibly, quite mathematically, it seems to line up pretty well. And then you've got all of the other things that tie in as well, that inverse correlation, the river, the Sphinx, all of these things meeting together become, again, yeah, highly improbable. One of these things on its own, you can say, okay, maybe that was an accident.
Yeah. But even the air shafts pinpointing it.
Exactly.
It's really the fact that it's all happening at 10,500 BC, which is
Plato says. It just happens.
Yeah. When the lion-shaped Sphinx is looking at the heliacal horizon of Leo, and when the Nile is matching the Milky Way, as you say. And then there's another, you know, all the pyramids, actually, they line up to, like, the 50 brightest stars this side of the Milky Way, all along the Nile.
Cool.
This scheme is much bigger and really fascinating.
Yeah, that stuff is probably, I think that's some of the most interesting stuff that we have. And a lot of people think that it's complete speculative bullshit, but I always have to point out that we've done this in the Hoover Dam. You know about that? In the Hoover Dam, there's a star chart that will tell you what it will build. And you have to be pretty adept at fucking astronomy, but I'll put an image of it on the screen here for the people at home. But yeah, there's the Hoover Dam, the guy built it, and he incorporated a star chart.
Wow.
So you could tell when it was built. So this isn't unheard of, nor is, I'm going to go out on a limb and say he probably inherited that idea from somewhere. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he probably found it as something interesting.
Probably Freemason, you know. Holding on to that
side
of stuff.
That couldn't be. No, Freemasons making buildings. No, the Hoover Dam, I'm sure that was just made by a regular dude. Regular dude.
Yeah.
Not a Freemason at all.
Well, you know, because they were working on Mount Rushmore. They definitely were. Even the Georgia Guidestones, there's all this archaeoastronomy built into their modern monuments. And look at Washington, D.C. Look at the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. All these Masonic monuments. They're holding on to these traditions of the mystery schools and these templates that were used in the sacred architecture. So from R.A. Schwaller de Lubick, master alchemist, mathematician, genius, French genius, he really opened the doors to that with the Temple of Man that had Luxor. These layouts and codes and spatial geometries are the templates for the human body, for stars. And they lay them out in these codes within the architectural templates of cathedrals as well. Like Fulcanelli's book, The Mystery of the Cathedral, gets very deep into it. But you can see the same patterns, for instance, laid out in the Temple of Luxor of Man at the Vatican, at St. Peter's Square.
Yeah.
It's laid along that whole avenue.
Interesting.
See them using the very same like sets of proportion and harmonics.
Interesting.
The whole science is placed into the architecture as a means of transmitting it to Egypt, that's really taken from the geniuses of Egypt. Even though the Freemasons and people today, they're not quite as adept at doing it, but they've lost a lot of the keys and obviously faced a lot of corruption and infiltration. But they do still hold some of that knowledge. You can see them using it.
The obelisk. So they stole all of them everywhere. Before we end our chat, we were talking about how the geology formed the Catskills and how that has to do with some of the rocks and stuff around here. You want to gabber about that for a minute?
Yeah. Well, the Catskills, if you consider the mountains, they're the oldest mountains in the United States. But some people technically don't call them mountains because they were formed in a different way. It's actually a plateau. a glaciated plateau. So the glaciers came over and scraped in all these valleys, and they're very natural, grounded, just hills, like big hills more than that.
Yeah.
They have a very special feel because of that. There's no others really quite like it. It's got a similar feel to the Appalachian Range, but, you know, the Blue Ridge Parkway, further south, but it's a different kind of mountains. The glacier coming through is really interesting because it opens up into this whole conversation about Immanuel Dolokhotsky we were talking about earlier. He was a man who is studying the origins of the ideas of the Ice Age when they first came up. If you look at his book, Earth in Upheaval, or Worlds in Collision, he was the one guy who was really standing by Charles Hapgood when the two of them kind of proposed the Earth crustal displacement theory. And a lot of the things that Velikovsky brought forward are the only explanation that we have at all, even proposed, for a lot of the enigmas we find. For instance, he was seeing these terminal moraines and the sized moraines, they call them, where the glacier at their greatest expansion would drop off the boulders all around the edge. And once it started receding, you'd see the imprint of its largest expansion basically left with stone. Some of what he was finding down by the equator, he was finding at the glacier. And some of those moraines were moving away from the equator. So this is evidence that, you know, the whole crust could have slipped at times and polar regions became tropical and vice versa. But this is also the only thing that really explains all these mammoths, you know, grazing on this vegetation that must
Buttercup
have existed.
Historically, that's the famous one. It's Buttercup and Dummy, right? Mouthful of Buttercup's the one.
They found undigested, even flash frozen, never thawed for thousands of years after, overnight. You know, so he believes that it did have something to do with the, you know, maybe the magma heated up, got more lubricated at time, and the crust just flipped. And, basically the whole scientific community called him crazy. They said, oh, you know, he was a heretic to all them, but Einstein endorsed both of them. But, everyone else kind of said he was off in rocket. But like, how do you guys explain these matters up there?
It was a crust displacement theory. I mean, it was always marginalized, but it did compete, with plate tectonics for a while. Like it was in the 50s. It was before everything was set in stone.
Bill Graham really helped with that. Of course, Fingerprints of the Gods, when he really shined a light on the Barry Reese map.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, the map, the source map that we used to that is even a more interesting mystery. But
yeah, of course. That'd be awesome, though.
One more survey. Supposedly, the map that Columbus used coming in.
Oh.
So if you read Manly Hall's book, The Keep Your Destiny of America, that one's really interesting. Talking about Christopher Columbus being a Greek prince, actually, and being the heir to this mystery school of knowledge going all the way back to Plato and his idea of such philosophy of city, and basically saying that the mystery school since the time of Atlantis, or whatever you want to call it, had held on to this knowledge not only of Atlantis, but of America. And they set this continent aside for this dream of restoring a global world peace run by the philosopher kings and a noble society. This is Plato's vision, and it's a
interesting.
There's a suggestion that, you know, Columbus was holding on to some of these secret records and knowledge from the mystery school, and this map that is used to make the Barry Reese map was very clearly one of the maps that was compiled at Alexandria. So that's where, you know, all the maps that came in Alexandria, they all got atlas together. And,
Alexandria, like for a time, they were with. There was a time where any boat that came in, they would peel any pieces of paper up, copy them, and give them back.
Yeah. So they keep the original and give you back a copy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that think that was because they were looking for lost knowledge, which, you know, would make sense.
Sure.
But awesome. Yeah. I appreciate it, Trevor. I'm going to make a couple of videos, at least one about Opus 40 and one about the rock walls and stuff around here, the chambers. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit and to look, put this out and let people, we'll talk, I'll show some of the books you showed and stuff. And,
yeah. Well, I kind of went off the rails there a little from that last question, but it does relate to the Catskills as well in terms of why we see all these massive boulders there.
Yeah.
Worse with is because these glaciers are just dropping them off.
Yeah. Glacial erratics all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really special landscape, and I'm so glad you got to see.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Got Sandy Duncan coming to the hometown. I'm like, that's time for a
Catskill
Mountain History Tour.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, we'll make the Italians jealous. You guys need to come visit. They're all busy.
Well, next time you come, we'll get Glenn Kreisberg to come, and we'll go walk up to some of the cairns with him and check them out.
Sounds great. Can't wait. Awesome. Thanks, Trevor.
Yeah, thanks so much, man.
Well, that was me and Trevor Grassi having a chat, and there's a couple of things to keep in mind as the video ends. Number one, go click on his channel and subscribe to it if you're not already, especially if you're into that Coffrey Scan stuff, man. He talks about it more than anyone. The other thing to keep in mind is the cool sites that he spoke about here, Opus 40 and a few of the other things I'm going to be covering, like I said at the beginning. So keep your britches on, and there will be some cool videos coming. That Opus 40 site in particular, holy shit. But anyway, thanks a lot for watching. I really appreciate y'all's support. I wouldn't even be able to think about going to freaking New York to meet somebody. It's like, I want to go hang out with this girl, so I'm going to go to New York and look at some cool old rocks while we're there. Without your support, and I don't mean necessarily on Patreon or being a channel member, just sitting and watching these damn videos and watching the ads every now and again, and just, you know, general stuff that makes the channel grow. Just typical YouTuber crap has allowed me to do that stuff. So thank you guys very, very much. And yes, I will get some merch coming soon. I'm sorry. I'm tired, man. All right. See you next time.